This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Animal Week on Fresh Air, and we'll be talking about animals in the wild, in backyards and homes, in prisons, and on Broadway. If you have a pet, chances are at some point you're going to have to make medical decisions far more difficult than the ones people had to make in the past, because there are more high-tech interventions available for animal cancer, kidney disease, brain tumors, etc., and the diagnostic procedures and treatments are expensive. My guest, Dr. Nancy Kaye, is a veterinarian who co-founded a 24-hour emergency specialty care center in California, where she treats cats and dogs. Her book, Speaking for Spot, offers advice on how to make medical decisions on behalf of your dog, including decisions about chemotherapy, pain management, and euthanasia. Dr. Nancy Kaye, welcome to Fresh Air. Here's something that's a really difficult dilemma. If your dog is already fairly old and has developed, say, cancer.
Yes.
And you as the vet decide that, you know, there should be tests and then, you know, chemotherapy would likely help the dog, but it's going to be very expensive. So then the person whose dog it is has to decide, well, if the dog is only going to live for, say, 2 or 3 more years under the best of circumstances because they're already kind of old, is it worth the investment? And then you hear yourself saying, is my dog worth the investment? And you don't want to be thinking that way, but you kind of have to if you don't have the money to spend. Mm-hmm. How much money are you going to spend on a dog who's not going to live many more years? How do you help people figure through really complicated questions like that?
Yes. Well, one of the things that I work really hard on myself, and I when I lecture to other veterinarians, I avoid saying, you should do chemotherapy, you should take these x-rays, you should do surgery to remove the tumor. What I view my job to be is to present every single option that I think is a feasible option for the dog, that I think could make sense for the dog, spell out all the different benefits and potential risks, educate the people as to how much it's going to cost, and let them decide based on what they know about their financial capabilities and, most importantly, what they know to be true about their dog to make the best decision. The whole goal of this medical advocacy is to make informed decisions. And with having a lot of information and making an informed decision, the goal is to come up with the very best choice that's hopefully going to provide the best outcome for the dog or the cat. And secondly, and almost as important, is to make a choice that's going to provide the most peace of mind for the human at the other end of the leash or the person lugging the cat carrier around. When you mention age, many people often say, oh, he's 12 years old. I'm not sure that I should do that. And one of the points that I always emphasize is rather than focusing on chronological age, I think it's important to focus on the functional age of the animal. For example, Terry, you and I could both be 80-year-old women and both in need of a knee replacement. You might be a great candidate for that surgery, where I might be a horrible candidate for that surgery. In other words, there's no cutoff to say that any woman over 80 years of age will not have a knee replacement. So, for example, a 12-year-old golden retriever who's up until a week ago was going to the dog park and playing like a banshee and having a great old time might be a great candidate to go in and remove a tumor in the spleen, whereas a 10-year-old dog that's really been struggling and having a hard time getting around might be a poor candidate.
What's chemo like for a cat or a dog? Do cats get chemo too?
Yes.
Yeah?
They do. I really like the ability to talk about this because whenever I introduce the notion of chemotherapy to a client, the very next sentence out of my mouth is chemotherapy is a whole lot different in dogs and cats than it is in people. Even though we're using the exact same drugs, dogs and cats, it's exceedingly rare that there's hair loss. And the likelihood of getting sick from chemotherapy is very low. As frequently as people get sick from chemotherapy, that's as infrequent as dogs and cats get sick from chemotherapy. The truth be told, Terry, if the outcome of treating dogs and cats with chemotherapy was like it is in people, all the vomiting, all the hair loss, all the misery, I think you'd find very few veterinarians willing to do it.
Mm-hmm. So what do to try to make the dogs you're giving chemo too comfortable?
Well, and for my patients, there's a 10-cookie minimum per visit. So there's lots of cookies.
What kind of cookies?
Dog cookies, dog biscuits.
Uh-huh.
So they get fed a lot of treats while they're with us. The people who work in veterinary hospitals, the nurses, the receptionists, they're not doing that work to get rich. Nobody's getting rich doing that. They love dogs and cats. They just love them. And so an animal comes in, they're going to be pet by all kinds of people. They're going to get all kinds of treats, all kinds of baby talk and attention. So they're treated very well. That being said, not all animals are suitable candidates for chemotherapy. And whenever I counsel people about chemotherapy protocols, we really take the animal's personality into account. For example, if a cat comes in and receives chemotherapy and then goes home and hides under the bed for 2 days, that's not reasonable.
Now, I could see what you said with dogs, that you're petting the dogs, you're talking to the dogs, you're giving the dogs the cookies. The dogs are kind of happy to be there.
Yeah.
Cats, I'm not so sure. I mean, cats hate going to, my cat anyways, hates going to the vet, hates being put in the carrier, knows there's something wrong just when the carrier gets taken out.
Right. And you have to sneak the carrier out, right?
Yeah,
otherwise your cat's going to disappear.
And cats don't respond to treats the way dogs do, and they don't respond to petting from strangers the way dogs do.
Right.
So what can you do to make a cat's experience a positive experience?
Right. Occasionally we have cats that are really outgoing in a veterinary hospital situation. In fact, one of the services we offer is an underwater treadmill for rehabilitation therapy, where you fill up basically it looks like an aquarium fish tank, and fill it with water to let the animal paddle in there to develop muscle strength, non-weight-bearing muscle strength. We even have a couple of cats that do that. But you're right. Most cats are stressed out by hospital visits. So for most cats, what we do is we give them places away from barking dogs, and we give them things to hide in. We have little cubbies they can hide in their cage. And cats that are food-motivated, they like to eat almost no matter where they are. So there's plenty of food for them as well.
So what are your little cat hiding places like?
They're kind of like big hats. They're pouches. And they're made of fleece and fluffy material, and they can crawl inside those.
Now, one thing you point out in your book that I think is important to mention is that, you know, dogs and cats don't know they have cancer. So they're not living with the anxiety that the humans are.
Right. They have perfected the art of living in the moment.
So they might be in discomfort, but they're not like worrying and saying, is this stage one or stage two of cancer? It's just
exactly
a different experience for an animal.
In fact, if I am treating an animal with chemotherapy and I know the cancer's gone and the client is telling me that the dog still seems kind of droopy, I always ask, is the dog sensing what you're feeling? When we treat, if let's say that we have a dog or a cat with lymphoma, that's a very treatable type of cancer, but we can't cure it. But what we can often achieve is a year of really good quality time. Sometimes we get 2 years. Sometimes we get 3 years. So in screening whether or not this patient is suitable for chemotherapy, we talk about the animal's personality. We talk about the person's philosophy about treating cancer. If they've just experienced the ravages of chemotherapy with a loved one, I can reassure them about chemotherapy till I'm blue in the face, but how can we expect them to face the notion of chemotherapy again for any of their loved ones? We talk about the financial implications. We talk about, will your work schedule allow you to come back and forth as frequently as you need to? And then the last thing that I address is, will you enjoy the honeymoon? Because we're doing this to provide really good quality time for you to share with your dog and cat. And if every waking hour is spent thinking about the fact that your animal has cancer and at some point will succumb to that disease, then should we really move forward?
If you're just joining us, my guest is veterinarian Dr. Nancy Kay, and she has a new book called Speaking for Spot, which is about how to be an effective advocate for your dog when it comes to your dog's health. Now, pain management is a growing part of veterinary medicine, just as it is in human
yes.
medicine. And I know, like when you have a problem that's pain related, and you go to the doctor as a human being, the doctor asks you to rate your pain scale on a 1 to 10. And I always think that's hard to do, but you do your best. You can't ask a dog or a cat to rate their pain. How do you evaluate how much pain a dog or a cat is in? And do you find that animals express their pain differently than humans do?
Yeah. It's so challenging, but we work really hard on it, and I'm really proud of our profession. We've come such a long way in terms of pain management. I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you, you know, I graduated veterinary school in 1982, and when we were doing, say, spay and neuter procedures, we weren't providing any pain medication routinely for those patients, which is appalling for me to think about now. What we do is, in our hospital setting, we actually have pain assessment every 2 to 4 hours, depending on the patient. The indicators that are the best indicators for dogs and cats as to how they're experiencing pain or whether they're experiencing pain have to do with heart rate, respiratory rate, and blood pressure measurements. So those are some three very tangible things we can be measuring to assess whether or not a patient is in pain. Sometimes we have to rely on giving pain medication and then seeing if the patient behaves differently. One of the things I always take into consideration is, how does an animal show that they have a headache? Let's say that an animal has a tumor growing inside its brain. Well, it may have an awful headache, and that doesn't mean that the patient's vomiting or pointing to its head. Usually that's an animal that's becoming reclusive, not nearly as social as he used to be, going off into a quiet room. So, Terry, this is one of the biggest challenges we face, is to feel confident that we are giving appropriate pain medications. But the field of pain management has really expanded exponentially. Acupuncture is used a lot for pain management, all different types of medications that can be given at home or in a hospital setting. We've come a long way.
Is whimpering for a dog or meowing for a cat a sign of pain? Do you use that? Do you use that when you're assessing an animal's pain?
If an animal has a broken leg or a slip disc in the back, you may be able to get them to vocalize when you press on that area. But especially for internal types of pain, there's not going to be much whimpering or crying. And people are often waiting to hear that. Dog owners, cat owners are often waiting to hear that before they bring their animal into the veterinarian, or especially before they consider euthanasia. But dogs and cats don't necessarily manifest their pain by whimpering and crying. This raises another point that's near and dear to my heart. One of the most common questions that I'm asked when people are trying to make their end-of-life decisions for their pets, which is always so difficult, they often ask, do you think that my dog or my cat is in pain? Because that's the main criteria they're using to determine when it's time to put their pet to sleep. And animals don't necessarily have to be in pain to be suffering. What I encourage people to think about is, consider the case of the flu. If you're in bed with the flu, how miserable you feel. If you were to feel like that day after day after day, you're suffering. You're not in pain, but certainly there's a huge element of suffering there.
What are the medications that you use when treating pain in an animal? Is it the same as the human medications?
Yes, it is. There's the narcotic classification of drugs, and then there's a whole host of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications. Mm-hmm. The equivalent of ibuprofen for people. That being said, the human non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications can be very dangerous for dogs and cats, so you need to stick with the ones that are formulated specifically for them.
My guest is veterinarian Nancy Kay, author of the book Speaking for Spot. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Dr. Nancy Kay. She co-founded a 24-hour emergency specialty care center in California where she treats cats and dogs. Her book, Speaking for Spot, offers advice on how to make difficult medical decisions on behalf of your dog. I'm sure one of the most difficult questions you're asked has to do with one of the most difficult decisions any person with a pet has to make, which is, how do I know when it's time, if it's time, to put my pet to sleep. What are some of the things you say to help one of your clients think through that really difficult question?
There's a few things I encourage them to think about. One of the things that I recommend is, does your dog or cat still respond enthusiastically to the things that would normally excite him, such as, if we're talking about a dog, the jingle of the car keys, if we're talking about a cat, the can opener opening the can of cat food? Is he excited by the sight of a tennis ball or dinner time or the mention of his favorite words, the ones that you normally would have to spell out in order to avoid getting him excited? Do the good days still seem to outnumber the bad days? That's real important. And then something that sounds a little bit corny, and it's probably okay because I'm in California, is to really go nose to nose and eyeball to eyeball with your cat or dog and have a look in your cat's or dog's eyes and see, is that same spark that you're used to still there? Sometimes that light flickers a little bit, and if their eyes are looking dull over a period of days, then I think that too is a really good indicator. The key here is everybody wants to make the decision at just the right time. They don't want to act prematurely. They don't want to do it too soon. But what I tell my clients is that the people, some of the people who have the hardest time who come to my support group are people who feel like they waited too long. So I encourage people to avoid getting into that situation where they're going to have guilt and regret that they really waited too long.
Did they allow their pet to endure suffering that they didn't need to endure?
Exactly.
You have something in your book that I found so interesting. You say for animals who hate going to the vet, taking them to the vet to be euthanized is going to be just a horrible experience for them because they're going to die with the anxiety that they have for any vet visit. And you recommend asking the vet to euthanize the animal in the car, if the car is a place they like. Like a lot of dogs love the car because it means they're going places. Have you done that, euthanized animals in the car?
Absolutely. I think people don't realize that there's a lot of choices that they have in terms of the euthanasia process and how they want to handle that. And one of the choices has to do with location. You don't want the last minute of the animal's life to be in a place where they're really miserable. Now, if the animal is really weak and quite out of it, they may not even recognize they're in a veterinary hospital setting. But many dogs feel like their cars or their trucks are their second home. So I'm very happy to go out into the vehicle and perform the euthanasia there if that's where my clients and their pets are most comfortable. And at-home euthanasias are also an option, and many veterinarians will do that for their clients. And if they're not available to do that, there's house call practitioners that'll go do that as well.
What are some of the things you've seen people do to reassure their animals as they're being euthanized?
Well, if they're still eating, there's a lot of food involved. There's a lot of stroking, a lot of loving.
I'm surprised about the food because I would think that it would be difficult, that it would make the process more difficult if an animal was digesting in the process. That's not a problem.
Well, have you ever been with an animal when it's been euthanized?
I haven't.
Okay. Do you mind if I tell you what happens?
No, please.
So many people are surprised about really what a quick, pain-free, simple process it appears to be. And it's kind of shocking sometimes how quick and simple it seems. What we do is we administer in the vein an injection that's in essence an overdose of an anesthetic agent. And for all practical purposes, it looks like the dog or cat is just going to sleep or going under anesthesia. And typically, it all occurs within about 15 to 20 seconds after administering the euthanasia solution. So what we typically do, what I like to do is place a catheter in the vein. We have a nice room with a couch where people can hang out and spend time and feed cookies and talk with their animals and spend as much time as they want before the euthanasia. And then typically when I'm administering the euthanasia solution, they're stroking, they're petting, they're crying. They're saying all the things that they really want to say to their dog or cat. I'm sorry, I get a little teary-eyed talking about it sometimes. And and if it's a dog that loves its food, then they're feeding dog biscuits. So it all happens very quickly. People are often surprised by how quickly it occurs.
Is it hard for you to do it?
It is. It is difficult, but it's just part of my job. And I know that by being there, by being present and handling things in a very smooth, gentle fashion, that I'm making a very difficult situation for someone else a little bit easier. Some patients get to me a whole lot more than others, patients that I have known for years, or patients where I really know in my heart of hearts what that bond is between them and their human. So sometimes it feels like a relief. You know, when an animal is really suffering, let's say they're breathing, they're struggling to breathe, and they can't get in enough oxygen, and you administer the euthanasia solution, and all that struggling goes away. And that feels like a huge relief. It really does. As though I've been unburdened somehow, and the people there have been unburdened. And I always tell people to stay as long as they like after the fact, because quite honestly, it just looks like their dog or cat are peacefully sleeping. And especially if an animal has been struggling, it can be a very peaceful time of closure.
We'll hear more from veterinarian Nancy Kay in the second half of the show. Her book and blog are called Speaking for Spot. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with veterinarian Nancy Kay. She co-founded a 24-hour emergency specialty care center in California where she treats cats and dogs. Her book, Speaking for Spot, offers advice on how to make medical decisions on behalf of your dog, including decisions about chemotherapy, pain management, and euthanasia. We've been talking about how you help people make tough decisions, medical decisions about their animals. You've had a lot of animals yourself.
Yes.
And I know you've had to make tough decisions about whether to do an invasive procedure or just keep the dog as comfortable as possible, decisions about whether it was time to put an animal to sleep or not. Tell us the story of one of your dogs who you've had to make a tough decision about whether to move forward with an invasive procedure or not.
What I would probably do is tell you about Vinny, who was one of our dogs. He passed away just over a year ago, a silly, goofy, lovable, wonderful golden retriever. And when he was 8 years of age, my husband, who's also a veterinarian, felt a lump on the top of his head, and it turned out to be a tumor that involved his skull bone. And the decision needed to be made, do we go ahead and try to remove that tumor? And he had no symptoms whatsoever. And if we removed the tumor, then there was a chance that we would be able to cure the disease or at least prevent it from progressing as rapidly as it would otherwise, because as this skull tumor would grow, it would compress on his brain and we'd end up with some neurological symptoms. Well, we decided to proceed with the surgery. To us, that was, no pun intended, a no-brainer. And the surgery was wonderfully successful. They removed what they thought probably was 95% of the tumor, and they had to remove a small portion of his brain, and for a golden retriever, that might not be all that much of an issue. But and he went on and did great and was doing his usual Tigger routine, jumping up and flying through the air one day, and tore his cruciate ligament. That's a ligament in the knee that large breed dogs are very predisposed to tearing. Well, then we had to decide, do we do this knee surgery on him? We don't know if this skull tumor is going to grow back, but he's going to be a very lame dog if we don't do the surgery. That was a little bit of a tough decision. And we took our chances. We did the surgery, and he did great for another year before yet a different type of cancer caught up with him.
And that cancer, were you able to do anything about that?
No, that was the life-ending cancer. He had a tumor on the base of his heart that we weren't able to fix. But the knee surgery in particular was challenging because we really didn't know if another major surgical procedure was worthwhile, if indeed within a few months the tumor affecting the brain would grow back.
So when you found out that your dog Vinny had a fatal form of cancer, did you immediately put him to sleep?
His situation, believe it or not, made our decision-making a little bit easier because his cancer caused bleeding into the pericardial sac around his heart, which is a situation that a dog really can't live with. And so he went from being a dog that was normal and active to being a dog that couldn't walk, couldn't get up, was struggling to breathe. It was one of those situations where we really knew that we had no choice. And as we typically do, my husband and I trade off who's going to be the one holding, who's going to be the one administering the injection. I will say that I keep expecting it to get easier, but it seems to, in fact, get a little bit harder each and every time.
Which is the harder part for you, holding or injecting, or are they both equally hard?
They're both equally hard. The holding is hard because you're so connected with what's happening with your animal. The injecting is hard because you can't participate in the emotional aspect of it quite as much.
When you lost your dog, when you put your dog to sleep, how long did it take before you wanted to adopt a new dog?
I really like this question because people often feel uncomfortable trying to figure out when to get their next dog.
It's so true. I know.
Because one family member might say, let's go get a dog tomorrow. And another person, it might take a whole year before they're ready. My husband and I, we had two dogs, and they both died within 6 months of each other. And we were dogless for the first time in 30 years. And neither of us were really ready to get another dog. And then it just so happened that a little stray came into my hospital one day. She was dirty, smelly, skinny. She had horrible skin disease. She was in heat. The receptionist brought her back to our treatment room, holding her well away from her body because she looked so gnarly and grungy. And there was just something about her eyes, and I took her home. And in fact, she's the dog that's on the back cover of my book. Her name is Nellie, and she's been a wonderful fit with our family.
Oh, she's adorable.
She is. She's a little doll.
Okay. So you must
be... So we ended up getting a dog within about a month of losing our two dogs.
Okay. And Vinny, the dog you were describing losing, was a golden retriever. He was a big dog, and this is a little dog. Have you had little dogs before?
No, we've gone little. Both of our current dogs are little dogs, and it's really rather fun.
What are some of the differences for you between a big and a small dog?
Bending down a lot more. you know, golden retrievers are often pretty simple-minded dogs. The dogs I've had in the past have always been very, whatever you want, Mom, I'll be the perfect dog. And little dogs, you know, I think they, in general, can be a little bit more intelligent about things and manipulating their moms and dads. And so these two have been a little bit more of a challenge to train.
Now, I want to end by asking you about the cover photo on your book, Speaking for Spot, the cover dog, because there's a nice story
Sandy
behind that. So tell us the story of this dog.
Sure. Sandy was brought in as a stray to the Marin Humane Society. Marin County is just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. And Sandy was one of the first dogs in the Pen Pal program. What the Pen Pal program is it's a relationship between the Marin Humane Society and San Quentin State Penitentiary. When the Marin Humane Society has dogs come in that need training and socialization, this sounds a little ironic, I know, or they're recovering from some sort of disease, they'll send these dogs over to San Quentin State Prison to work with prisoners. And the prisoners, it's a real privilege for them to be able to work with these dogs. They work on training them and socializing them. In Sandy's case, she was recovering from heartworm disease, so she had to be kept quite quiet. And she was just a crazy girl. She was wild with no manners. So she joined up with an inmate who taught her, I believe, 14 different commands. One of the commands was stay, and the release from the stay command was the word parole. Sandy and her inmate managed to be released from San Quentin at the same time, and they actually lived together for about a year. And then that fellow had to move back east because of a death in the family and wasn't able to take Sandy with him. So Sandy went back to the Marin Humane Society and was adopted by a wonderful family who live in Marin County. And Sandy's come to a number of my local book signings. The only quibble I have with her is she's about 10 pounds overweight, and I keep talking to her mom and dad about that.
Well, such a great story. Dr. Kay, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Nancy Kay co-founded a 24-hour emergency specialty care center in California. Her book and blog are called Speaking for Spot. Our interview was recorded in March. Coming up on Animal Week, what Alex the Parrot taught us about how animals think and what they're capable of comprehending. This is Fresh Air. How many times have you wished you could talk with your pet and find out what they're thinking? My guest, Irene Pepperberg, wanted to conduct research into animal thinking, so she bought a talking bird from a pet store, a gray parrot she named Alex. Her idea was to replicate the linguistic and cognitive breakthroughs demonstrated in research with chimps using an animal that could talk. Alex became her good friend as well as her longtime research subject. As a result of their work together, he probably became the most famous parrot in the world. When he died 2 years ago at the age of 31, he got an obit in the New York Times headlined, "Brainy Parrot Dies, Emotive to the End." Pepperberg has written a memoir called Alex and Me. She's now an associate research professor at Brandeis University. Irene Pepperberg, welcome to Fresh Air. How many words was Alex capable of saying?
It's hard to say because there were some that were just contextually applicable. Something like, I'm sorry. There was no contrition. It was just something to say when he had done something wrong and everybody made sure he knew that it was something wrong. But there was good data on about 50 different object labels, 7 colors, 5 shapes, quantities up to 8 just before he died. And then he would combine these to identify, request, refuse, categorize, quantify, more than 100 different things in the laboratory. So once he knew block, then he knew green and yellow and orange, and so he could identify the green block, the yellow block, the orange block, things like that.
How much ability did he have as a parrot to pronounce the words that you wanted him to say?
He got most of them right. There are some of them that are really tough. Like, imagine saying paper without lips. And he actually did that. But final S's always seemed to get him. So he would say things like Alec instead of Alex. If the S was in the middle of a sentence, like, what's that? Not a problem. Or what's same? Not a problem. He would say six by saying sick. And we had to really push him to say sick, sick, to get that final S type noise. So there were some things that were tough.
We have lips, and that helps us pronounce. Parrots don't. They have beaks. So that must be an impediment for subtle variations of vowels and consonants.
Not so much the vowels. His vowels come out looking exactly like ours. They're really quite similar. The change comes on those consonants, those p and v and b sounds that we use our lips. And he uses esophageal speech to do that. Mm-hmm. So just like people have had laryngectomies, he will kind of burp those sounds in some way. They don't look that different on the sonograph, but they come up at very different energies.
What do you think your work with Alex and with your other parrots disproves about preconceptions of the abilities of animals to think and communicate?
Well, what Alex really did was lay waste to the term bird brain as something derogatory. He really did show that this creature with a brain the size of a shelled walnut could do the same types of tasks that the apes did and the dolphins did, and in many cases, young children could do. It was a major breakthrough. Before I started my work, which was in the 70s, most people were studying pigeons. They were studying through a procedure called operant conditioning, where you starve an animal down to about 80% of its normal body weight, put it in a box with nothing in the box other than a couple of buttons, and you do a lot of tasks using those buttons and trying to see what the animal can do. And obviously, we did things in very different ways. Instead, we treated animals.
I should just say, you're talking about starving the animal, so it would be receptive to food as a reward stimulus?
Correct. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I should have mentioned that, yes. And the rewards would have nothing to do with the task that you were giving the animal. So if you were trying to do, say, you know, if the animal could do a match to sample, meaning you show it a red light and then you give it a sample of red and green lights and see if it could learn to hit the red light appropriately. And then if you change the sample to a green light, could it switch over to hitting the green light? And you give it a little piece of food as its reward. This was not the way to treat an animal if you wanted to get communication. What another big difference in what we did was we trained Alex to label objects that he initially wanted. So there was a real incentive for him to learn to say key, because that was something he could use to scratch himself, or wood, because that was something he enjoyed chewing. And these were his primary rewards, the close correlation of the label and the object to be learned.
You know, as you mentioned before, you didn't use the behavioral sciences model of conditioning with your parrots. Can you describe the training models that you used to teach your parrots how to communicate?
We use something called the model rival technique, and it is very, very simple. We started by finding objects the bird wanted, and we would decide to train him those labels. So the bird would be on a perch. My student and I would have this object, say it was a piece of wood that the bird really wanted to chew. And I would show it to my student, who is the model for the bird's behavior and its rival for my attention. And I'd ask her, "What's this?" And she'd say, "Wood." And I'd say, "That's right, it's wood." And I'd give it to her, and she'd go, "Wood, wood, wood." And she'd proceed to break it apart. And the parrot's, you know, practically falling off the perch. Alex really wanted this object, and he was really watching. And then we exchange roles of model, rival, and trainer. So the bird saw that one person was not only the questioner and the other one the respondent, but it was an interactive process. And she'd show it to me, and I'd go, "What?" And she'd turn away and go, "No, you're wrong." So the bird would see that not any weird new noise would transfer the object. And she'd give me another chance, and I'd say, "Wood," and I'd get it, and we'd play that game again. And we'd do this several times, and then we'd show it to the bird. Now, at the beginning, Alex obviously wouldn't just say, "Wood," but he might go something like, "Oop," a new noise, and we'd reward that. And then over several weeks, we would shape it up into something that sounded like wood.
What about things like numbers? How would you get Alex to understand that three objects meant the number three?
That was really interesting because for him, you know, wood was wood. So what's this business of all these numbers of woods? And we do it using the same modeling technique. I'd show, you know, this is wood, and then I would put a couple more pieces on the tray, and I'd say, "This is three wood." And the student would go, "Three wood," and, you know, get the reward. And then she could play with all three pieces of wood. And Alex, if he said three, could play with all three pieces of wood.
So do you think he could count?
He did. We really had data on counting. And when we did a study on addition with Alex, we would put numbers of things under cups. And they would be, let's say, two nuts under one cup and three nuts under the other cup. And we lift the first cup and we say, "Look." And after a second, cover those nuts. Pick up the second cup, show it to him for a second, say, "Look," put it down. And then with both cups on the tray covering the nuts, we'd say, "How many?" And he'd say five, and he was fine. But he couldn't do five and zero, five nuts under one cup and no nuts under the other. And we couldn't figure that out at first. Every time we did that, he'd say six. And then it finally dawned on me that, ooh, maybe he's doing what humans do. We're not giving him time to actually count. So we finished the second half of the trials, giving him now maybe 5 or 6 seconds. And lo and behold, he could do it. So this was our real evidence that he was literally counting because he needed time to perceive all those things under the cup.
What do you consider some of the most advanced things linguistically and conceptually that Alex was able to achieve?
When we were studying concepts of same and different, we taught him the label none to refer to absence of similarity or difference. So we'd show him two objects and say what's same or what's different, and he'd say color, shape, matter, or none, if nothing were same or different. Without any prompting, he transferred this when we did concepts of bigger and smaller. So the first time we showed him something that was the same size, and we said, "What color bigger?" He looked at me and he said, "What same?" And I said, "Well, you tell me." And he said, "None." And then the really exciting part came when we were doing number comprehension. And we gave him trays of different sets of objects with different colors and numbers. So there would be, for example, a tray of 3 yellow blocks, 4 purple blocks, and 6 orange blocks. And the question would be, what color 3? So he'd have to understand the number 3, what it meant, find the set of blocks that were 3, which would be all mixed up, all the different colors would be mixed up on the tray, and then tell me the color of the set that was 3. And he did this for about 12 sessions perfectly well. And then, and it's a bit anthropomorphic, but he would get bored. And he would, what he would start doing would be to throw everything on the tray on the floor with his beak, just knock it off, or give me colors that weren't on the tray, or turn his back to me and say, "Want to go back?" And be very clear that he didn't want to work. And so you start getting inventive, and you start using things like jelly bellies instead of wooden blocks, and that he would get one of those for his reward. And you're pushing the edge of the envelope a lot. And then one day I come in and I show him trays, and it was 3, 4, and 6 things on the tray. And I said, "Alex, what color 3? And he looks at me and he looks at me and he says, 5. And I'm thinking, huh, there's no 5 things on the tray. And so I say, "Alex, come on, what color 3? Let's go." And he looks at me again And he says, 5. And this goes back and forth several times. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? He's not throwing everything on the floor. He's not giving me wrong colors. He's saying a different number. And there isn't any of the stuff on the tray. So I finally said, okay, Smarty, you know, what color 5? Not knowing what to expect. And he looks at me and he says, none. So not only did he transfer this information from that other task to this task, but he was responding to an absence of number, a kind of zero-like concept. Plus, he had figured out how to manipulate me into asking him the question that he wanted to answer, which I think was pretty sophisticated on his part.
My guest is Irene Pepperberg. We'll talk more about the research she conducted with her parrot, Alex, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Irene Pepperberg. We're talking about her work with her now famous African gray parrot, Alex, with whom she conducted pioneering research into animal linguistics and cognition. Alex died in 2007. Pepperberg's memoir is called Alex and Me. You describe a time when you were teaching at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and you were living outside the city, and you had brought Alex home with you, which you didn't typically do. And there were a couple of owls outside the window, which terrified your parrot, Alex. And would you describe the communication that happened after he got really freaked out by the owls?
Yeah, I mean, normally when I would bring him home, the first minute or two, you know, he was outside of his carrier and in his trap, this new cage that I would have for him, he would say, "Want to go back?" And I'd say, "Oh, just calm down. You're fine." And then he would look around the cage, see there was food, there was water, there were toys, and okay, he was fine, and he would settle down. Well, this time he was just going on and on, want to go back, want to go back, want to go back. And he's staring out the window. And I finally realized that there were these little screech owls, little tiny screech owls that were nesting up there. And so my first response was to just close the shade and say, look, they're out there, you're in here, you're safe. But Alex had something called object permanence, and he knew those owls were still out there. And he just kept insisting, want to go back, want to go back. So I had to take him in the carrier and bring him back to the lab that night, and he never really came back to the house after that.
Alex was hospitalized with a life-threatening infection. How did you try to communicate with him when you had to leave him at the hospital?
Oh, that was so incredibly difficult. He knew phrases like, you know, I'll see you tomorrow, I'll be back, because we would say that every night when we put him in the cage. And so here we're not leaving him in its normal place. I mean, we're putting him in this little hospital cage in a strange place with all these people, many of whom he didn't know. He knew the vets themselves, but not the technicians. And as I walk out the door, he looks at me in this, and he says in this pitiful little voice, I'm sorry, come here, want to go back. And you sit there and look at him and go, oh, well, how am I going to explain this? And I just kept saying, I'll be in tomorrow. I'll see you tomorrow. I promise. I'll see you tomorrow. And finally, he calmed down. And, of course, I made sure that I was there tomorrow.
How do you think he knew to say, I'm sorry?
Well, that was, again, it was something we call contextually applicable. When he did something bad, you know, if he bit somebody or if he threw things on the tray and we'd get angry at him and, you know, we'd say, bad boy, you know, don't do that. No, he learned over time that, you know, the phrase, I'm sorry, was very good. He would say it in this pathetic little voice, I'm sorry. And, of course, you go, oh, you know, your heart melts, even though you know there's no contrition. So that was something that he had associated. And I guess something in his little bird brain said, oh, they put me in this horrible place because I've been a bad boy. And maybe if I say I'm sorry, you know, things will get better. I'm just guessing at that.
You know, the story of Alex's death is just so sad. You learned about it through an email that you got in the morning at your home from one of the people working in the lab who delivered the sad news. Were you able to actually find out how Alex died?
The autopsy did not show a lot by sort of subtraction. My veterinarian assumed that it was heart arrhythmia because there was nothing obvious. And he did have a little bit of arteriosclerosis, which meant that if there was a heart arrhythmia, things could have shut down and it could have happened very quickly. And certainly, you know, we gave him the best foods and healthy foods, and he had just had a checkup the week before. I mean, it was just like the middle-aged guy who goes to his doctor, and the doctor does all the tests and says, hey, you're great, you'll live another 30 years. And the guy walks out the door and, you know, collapses, and that's sort of what happened.
What do you believe now about the potential of animals to communicate that you weren't sure of when you started your research?
That potential is much greater. I think that for many animals, we need to figure out the appropriate channels to use. Obviously, Alex could talk. People who work with apes use computers and sign language. People who work with dolphins also use computers and sign language. It's a matter of figuring out what medium. I mean, to emphasize the communication with humans in some ways is unfair because they have their own communication systems that work wonderfully well in the niche in which they live. And in a sense, pushing them to communicate with us is unfair. But it's one way of our actually getting, as Don Griffin, my mentor, would say, getting a window into their minds to actually determine how they process information, how they think, by giving them these tools.
Irene Pepperberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're so welcome. Pleased to be here.
Irene Pepperberg's memoir about her research with her parrot is called Alex and Me. Our interview was recorded last year when it was published. Our Animal Week series continues tomorrow.